Now I call upon David then to give us that necessary word of exhortation.
Morning, brothers and sisters. This morning I thought I would exhort you from that New Testament reading we had and look particularly at the last verse in chapter 3, which reads, "But we all, with open face, beholding as in a glass the glory of the Lord, are changed into the same image from glory to glory, even as by the Spirit of the Lord." And it's quite a complex verse, isn't it? But I think it's a key verse. And it introduces us to one of the major ideas that runs throughout the whole of this second epistle of Corinthians. And that idea is the word glory. The word glory, I don't know if you ever looked at it, but it appears 31 times in this epistle. And it would appear to me that chapters 3 and 4 of this epistle, which we read this morning, appears at first sight just to be introduced for no apparent reason, and then the Apostle Paul goes off onto other subjects. But in hindsight, it's clear that these two chapters are, if you like, a major platform to the whole logic and argument of the epistle. And I don't know about you, but in my view, this epistle is probably one of the more complex and closely reasoned letters in the whole of the New Testament. And it's also apparent that it gives us an insight into the Apostle Paul in the way that probably none of the other lectures, the other epistles do. So it's very instructive, but it's very dense and maybe not the most reader-friendly, particularly if you're reading it in the Authorised Version. So let's just come back then, before we get distracted, on this idea of glory and consider what it actually means. So the word glory, when it refers to God and to his covenants, then it is speaking about the revelation and the manifestation of all that God is and his character. It is effectively speaking about his kingship, his splendor, his righteousness, his character, his physical attributes, and his work. And it is absolutely worth noting the words that Paul wrote in Timothy regarding this glory of God, because in Timothy we read, "Who only hath immortality, dwelling in the light which no man can approach unto, whom no man hath seen nor can see, to whom be honour and power everlasting. Amen." And that word honour is the word glory. And there's a principle here that sinful flesh and blood cannot look upon the glory of God, because it is altogether too wonderful. So that's the first definition of glory, but there's a second one. And the second one is the idea of giving honour. So in the Ten Commandments we read, "Honour your father and mother." And that word honour is the word glory. And the underlying idea is that if we give someone honour or we give someone glory, it means to give them obedience, to give them respect, and to be obedient to them. Now, there's a third definition. This is the final one. Sorry about this. This is the boring bit. We've got to do this bit. The third definition is when one is glorying about oneself. And that just simply means boasting. So those are the three definitions of the word. It appears 31 times in this epistle. The context makes it very clear which of those three meanings should actually be applied. But let's just have a look now at the background to this epistle. There are three issues, brothers and sisters, substantive issues that the epistle deals with. The first one, it was in our readings yesterday, It's there in chapter 2 and verse 4. It says, verse 3 for connection, "And I wrote this same unto you, lest when I came I should have sorrow from them of whom I ought to rejoice, having confidence in you all that my joy is the joy of you all. For out of much affliction and anguish of heart I wrote unto you with many tears, not that ye should be grieved, but that ye might know the love which I have more abundantly unto you. But if any have caused grief, he hath not grieved me." And so it goes on, and we know the account. The question is, what is Paul actually talking about? Well, the answer is he's talking about that disciple who was disfellowshipped as a consequence of what he wrote in his first epistle, and it's set out in 1 Corinthians chapter 5. The disciple who committed sexual impropriety was disfellowshipped, and now, because he's repented, the Apostle Paul says, you need to bring him back into fellowship immediately. This is a worked example, if you like, of our fellowship and the practice of fellowship worked through. Love and forgiveness are at the top of the page, and we do well to mark it. The second issue is set out in 2 Corinthians chapters 8 and 9. Won't go into any detail there. We know what it's about. It's about the collections for the poor saints in Jerusalem that they might be able to provide relief. And the third issue is all the way through this epistle. It crops up all the way through, but is dealt with explicitly from 2 Corinthians chapter 10 right the way through to the end of the epistle. And that third issue is about ecclesial life for the Apostle Paul. And the situation, the background is found in Acts chapter 15, where we have that conference of the apostles in response to the Judaizers. Now, what is clearly happening here is that Paul is going around the known world, he's preaching the truth, he has converts, he's setting up the ecclesias, he's strengthening the ecclesias, putting them in place, and moving on to the next city. As he moves on to the next city, the Judaizers are moving in behind him, moving into those ecclesias and corrupting them. And this is a major problem for him. So when we look at 2 Corinthians chapter 11 as an example, and verse 13, we get the detail of this. Verse 12 for connection. "But what I do, that I will do, that I may cut off occasion from them which desire occasion, that wherein they glory, they may be found even as we. For such are false apostles, deceitful workers, transforming themselves into the apostles of Christ. And no marvel, for Satan himself is transformed into an angel of light." This angel of light, who is satanic, was probably known by Paul, a specific person who was orchestrating this based on letters and authority from the temple in Jerusalem. And the Apostle Paul has picked this up, and he's working his way through this issue all the way through this epistle. And the interesting thing is that not only are they actually corrupting the ecclesias, but they are attacking the Apostle Paul specifically. They have argued, if we can dismantle Paul as the apostle, we can dismantle his message. And so Paul is left with this horrendous situation of being a fool for their sake in glorying about his own apostleship, that he could establish himself as the apostle. Why? Well, because he needs to validate the message he has given. That's what's going on. And interestingly, in this context, if we come to 2 Corinthians chapter 12 and verse 7, that troublesome verse, it actually all falls into place when you look at that verse. It says, "And lest I should be exalted above measure through the abundance of the revelations, there was given to me a thorn in the flesh, the messenger of Satan to buffet me, lest I should be exalted above measure." That Satan that was buffeting him was that same disciple that had been turned into the angel of light. It caused Paul physical pain as a result of this frustration. And what are we told? He says, verse 8, "For this thing I besought the Lord thrice, that it might depart from me. And he said unto me, My grace is sufficient for thee, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. Most gladly, therefore, will I rather glory in my infirmities, that the power of Christ may rest upon me. Therefore I take pleasure in infirmities, in reproaches, in necessities, in persecutions, in distresses, for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then am I strong." Now what's actually going on here is that the wisdom of God is greater than the wisdom of Paul. Because what's being said here is that that Judaizing influence is apparently let to have full influence on the ecclesias. Why? Well, because then Paul, moved by this, would write these superlative epistles that we have that define the truth for our benefit. So that's the background, as it were, to much of this epistle. As I say, it's very, very closely argued, and Paul has to lay himself bare, as it were, to get these arguments across. So let's just turn then back to chapter that we read together, particularly chapter 3, which I'm going to focus our attention on now. And notice how this ideas that we've already looked at permeate through the verses. Verse 1, "Do we begin again," says Paul, "to commend ourselves?" That's the position that they have been pushed into because of these false or super apostles that had infiltrated the ecclesia. "Or need we, as some other epistles, of commendation to you, or letters of commendation from you? Ye are our epistle, written in our hearts, known and read of all men. Forasmuch as ye are manifestly declared to be the epistle of Christ, ministered by us, written not with ink, but with the Spirit of the living God, not in tables of stone, but in fleshly tables of the heart." Now, we have here an indirect reference to the whole situation that was unfolding on Mount Sinai, haven't we? That's the idea that the Apostle Paul is drawing out in terms of bringing out this principle, that it's not just about words on a page or letters on a stone. It's about actually impacting us upon our hearts and our minds, and as a consequence, shaping us. So we've been describing here that process in the Mount, and it's talking about glory. So let's just go there. Let's have a look, see what we have as an account in the book of Exodus. I'd like to turn to Exodus chapter 24, if I may. And what we read there in verse 1, it says, "And God said unto Moses, Come up unto the Lord, thou and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel, and worship ye afar off. And Moses alone shall come near the Lord. But they shall not come nigh, neither shall the people go up with you." And the context here is that they've just gone through the entry into the old covenant. The Ten Commandments have been given, The people have said, all that you said, we shall do. And therefore, Israel now is placed in a special position. And as a consequence, there's going to be a fellowship meal, brothers and sisters. It's interesting, isn't it? The verse 8 says, and Moses took the blood and sprinkled it on the people and said, behold, the blood of the covenant which the Lord hath made with you concerning all these words. Then went up Moses, Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel. And they saw the El. I'm sorry enough to use this phrase now. I hope it doesn't cause any offence. But to make the distinction, you'll see why. They saw the Elohim of Israel, the angel of Israel. And there was under his feet, as it were, a paved work of sapphire stone, and as it were, the body of heaven in his clearness. And upon the nobles of the children of Israel, he laid not his hand. Also they saw Elohim and did eat and drink. This is a remarkable situation. They have been given this great privilege. This is the glory, or part of the glory, of the Old Covenant. And it speaks of the kingdom, and it speaks of that fellowship meal that we shall enjoy with Christ when he returns. It speaks of so many of the things that we hold dear in type and shadow. But notice what it goes on to say. This is very, very specific. In verse 12 it says, and Yahweh said unto Moses, come up to me into the mount, and be there, and I will give thee tables of stone, and a law and commandments which I have written, that thou mayest teach them. And Moses rose up, and his minister Joshua, and Moses, which is a type of the Lord Jesus Christ, and Moses went up into the mount of God, and he said unto the elders, tarry ye here for us until we come again unto you. And behold, Aaron and Hur are with you. If any man have any matters to do, let him come unto them. And Moses went up into the mount. And notice this. A cloud covered the mount. So it was obscured. We're talking now about the glory of God. The glory of Yahweh is obscured. And the glory of the Lord abode upon Mount Sinai, and the cloud covered it 6 days. And the seventh day he called unto Moses out of the midst of the cloud, and the sight of the glory of the Lord was like devouring fire on the top of the mount in the eyes of the children of Israel. So they saw again some of the glory of God, but not in absolute clarity. It was shrouded by that cloud. And Moses went up into the midst of the cloud and gat him up into the mount. And Moses was in the mount 40 days and 40 nights. Now, he didn't see Yahweh, brothers and sisters. Didn't see him because of the cloud. But he saw the glory and was in his presence 40 days and 40 nights. They saw the glory of the Elohim, the angels, those who did not carry the name of Yahweh. Now, there's a distinction that this passage is making here, a very important one. We then have in Exodus these accounts of the instructions that God gave to Moses when he was in it. It talks about the tabernacle, how it should be constructed and set up, etc., and all the other arrangements that would be put in place for the worship of God. And then we have in chapter 32, the incident regarding the golden calf. There is less than 6 weeks have taken place, and Israel has already broken the covenant. Not just broken it, they've broken the very first commandment. And this is what Paul is referring to in the 2nd of Corinthians chapters 3 and 4. They have broken the covenant. And as a consequence of that, the status that they were to share and their relationship to God and their relationship to the glory of God has changed. And it's set out at the end of this chapter. So we go into Exodus chapter 32 and verse 33. It says, "And the Lord said unto Moses, Whosoever hath sinned against me, him will I blot out of my book. Therefore now go, lead the people unto the place of which I have spoken unto thee. Behold, mine angel shall go before thee." Not the angel that has the name of God in it. Not that angel with the glory of God would go with the people now. No, it was another angel, a lesser angel. "Nevertheless, in the day when I visit, I will visit their sin upon them. And the Lord plagued the people because they made the calf which Aaron made. And the Lord said unto Moses, Depart and go up hence, thou and the people which thou hast brought up out of the land of Egypt, unto the land which I swear unto Abraham, Isaac, and to Jacob, saying, Unto thy seed will I give it, and I will send an angel before thee, and I will drive out the Canaanite, the Amorite, the Hittite, and the Perizzite, and the Hivite, and the Jebusite, unto a land flowing milk and honey, for I will not go up in the midst of thee." Notice that, verse 3. "I will not go up in the midst of thee." He was not to be present in the camp of Israel. Why? Because they were a stiff-necked people. "For thou art a stiff-necked people, lest I consume thee in the way." So there has been a re-establishment of the covenant, but a change in the way that God is proposing now to deal with this nation Israel. And the consequence of that is when the people heard these evil tidings, they mourned. "And no man did put on him his ornaments," and so on. But what we then have in chapter 33 is this superlative chapter which deals with the intercession of Moses on their behalf. Now, I haven't got time to go through that now this morning, you'll probably be pleased to know. But as a consequence of that intercession, which demonstrates the effective power of prayer in a worked out example, Moses has turned this whole situation around and re-established Israel back to where they were before the golden calf incident. And as a consequence of that, we have this amazing situation where Moses and Yahweh, I'm talking about the angel with God's name placed within him, have this relationship now which is completely transformed. But notice what he says there in verse 17 of chapter 33. It says, "And the Lord said unto Moses, I will do this thing also that thou hast spoken, for thou hast found grace in my sight, and I know thee by name." There was an intimacy now in this relationship between Yahweh and Moses that hadn't been there before as a result of this intercession. And he said, Moses said, "I beseech thee, show me thy glory." Notice that. He spent days and days with God, with Yahweh, and he hadn't seen him. And now he's saying, please show me thy glory. So that reading of chapter 24 and that explanation is correct. They hadn't seen the glory of Yahweh. They saw the glory of the angel, Elohim, but not Yahweh. And he said, "I will make all my goodness pass before thee, and I will proclaim the name of the Lord before thee, and will be gracious to whom I will be gracious, will show mercy on whom I will show mercy." And he said, "Thou canst not see my face," 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 16, "for there shall be no man shall see me and live." And the Lord said, "Behold, there is a place by me, and thou shalt stand upon a rock. And it shall come to pass, while my glory passeth by, that I will put thee in a clift of the rock, and will cover thee with my hand while I pass by. And I will take away mine hand, and thou shalt see my back parts, but my face shall not be seen." That is the extent of the glory as a special dispensation for Moses that he was going to see. Just the hind part, just a glimpse of Yahweh, so that he didn't die. very limited, partial understanding, perception and sight of the glory of God. And in the interactions that take place, Moses' appearance changes. And at the end of chapter 34, verse 29, we read this. And it came to pass when Moses came down from Mount Sinai with the two tables of testimony in Moses' hand, when he came down from the mount, that Moses was not aware that the skin of his face shone while he talked with him. And when Aaron and all the children of Israel saw Moses, behold, the skin of his face shone. And notice this, they were afraid to come nigh him. They were afraid. They were condemned by their sin. And this covenant that is entered into, as Paul says in 2 Corinthians, has a glory that tendeth unto death, in sharp contrast to the glory of the new covenant that tendeth unto life. And Moses called unto them, and Aaron and all the rulers of the congregation returned unto him, and Moses talked with them. And afterward, all the children of Israel came nigh, and he gave them in commandment all that the Lord had spoken with him in Sinai. Till Moses had done speaking with them, he put a veil on his face. Now, this is a prophecy. It's a prophecy that this covenant that the Jews believed was an eternal, everlasting covenant was not an eternal, everlasting covenant. The glory of this covenant was going to fade because God was going to remove the covenant. But they never, ever, ever saw that prophecy because Moses covered his face. And therefore, Israel only had part of the information. They were blinded, or at best, partially sighted. So let's just summarise. And this is the argument that the Apostle Paul is putting to the Corinthians. The argument is this, in a nutshell, I think. Israel, and by implication the Judaizers, Israel did not see at any time the full glory of Yahweh. And therefore they have no real understanding of what that full glory and splendour is. And the second point is, they did not appreciate that that glory associated with that covenant was going to fade, because that covenant was not an everlasting covenant. A point they have never, ever appreciated. Now, let's compare that to the new covenant. Come with me, please, to Hebrews chapter 1, which we know very well. God, who at sundry times and in diverse manners spake in time past unto the fathers by the prophets, hath in these last days spoken unto us by his Son, whom he hath appointed heir of all things, by whom also he made the worlds, or the eternal ages, who being the brightness of his glory, and the express or very image of his substance, or person, and upholding all things by the word of his power, when he had, by himself, purged our sins, sat down on the right hand of the majesty on high, being made so much better than the angels, as he hath, by inheritance, obtained a more excellent name than they. That name, of course, being the name Yahweh. He has been exalted and given that name. Why? Because he's manifested the character of God. But the point is, there in verse 3, being the brightness of his glory and the express image of his person. We have seen it. We have seen Christ, and therefore we have seen the glory of God. Not partially, fully. That's the difference. So if we come to John chapter 1. John, at the very beginning in this gospel record, makes the point. He brings the comparison before us. It's there in 1 John chapter 1 and verse 14. Again, we know these words so well. And the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory, the glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. There is a manifestation, a perfect manifestation of God's glory in terms of his character. John bare witness of him and cried, saying, "This was he of whom I spake. He that cometh after me is preferred before me, for he was before me. And of his fullness have all we received, grace for grace. For the law was given by Moses, but grace and truth came by Jesus Christ." He's the one we've come to remember this morning. There is, if you like, a superiority between the two covenants that is expressed and found in the detail of the glory that is revealed. And the Apostle Paul is setting that down in the epistle right at the very beginning, so that later on when he makes that argument about the Judaizers, what is he saying? He's saying, well, they're blind. How can you ask them to teach you if they're blind? They haven't seen the wonderful things that you have seen. That's the argument. And really the exhortation becomes manifestly apparent, I would suggest, having gone through that exercise. So if you come back to 2 Corinthians and chapter 3. So what is the exhortation after all of that? Verse 17, "Now the Lord is that Spirit," Jesus Christ is the Spirit, the power, and also that mind, that attitude, "and where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is liberty." So we are freed from the constraints of the law and subject to grace. We're free from the condemnation of the law and the death that applies with that first covenant. "But we all with open face," Revised Version, "reflecting as a mirror the glory of the Lord, are transformed into the same image from glory to glory, even as from the Lord the Spirit." Now I think hopefully you can start to understand, if you did before anyway, but I'm sure, what this word is saying. We've come from glory, he says, from the old covenant, the glory of death, to the glory of life, the new covenant. We are required to manifest that same glory in our lives now. In other words, the righteousness, the character of Christ. That's what we're required to do. And as we break bread and drink wine, we are required to discern that character, to discern that glory, and to strive to reflect it in our lives. So one final reference is back into John's Gospel, if I may, please. I'll read these words and I'll then sit down and we will enjoy fellowship one with the other. So it's John chapter 17, verse 1. "These words spake Jesus and lifted up his eyes to heaven and said, Father, the hour has come, glorify thy Son. Give honour to thy Son, that thy Son may glorify or honour thee. As thou hast given him power over all flesh, that he should give eternal life to as many as thou hast given him. And this is life eternal, that they might know thee, the only true God." Yes, we can do that because we know Christ, whereas Israel didn't. "We can know the true God and Jesus Christ, whom thou hast sent. I have glorified thee on the earth. I have finished the work which thou gavest me to do. And now, O Father, glorify thou me with thine own self, with the glory which I had with thee before the world was. I have manifested thy name unto the men which thou gavest me out of the world. Thine they were, and thou gavest them to me, and they have kept thy word. Now they have known that all things whatsoever thou hast given me are of thee.
Thank you.